Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Are you a dietary crackhead? Well, that's the question posed by today's guest in his book, The D-Flame Diet. He's an important guy because he was perhaps the first individual to coin the term anti-inflammatory diet and conversely pro-inflammatory diet and make the connection between diet and inflammatory processes, which may be the underlying cause of virtually all diseases known to man, as well as the aging process itself, which is sometimes referred to as inflammaging. And in part two, this part of our podcast, I want to get into some particulars about what to eat and what not to eat. First of all, let's look at the super pro-inflammatory foods. Why is sugar pro-inflammatory? What about sugar and refined carbohydrates, high glycemic index foods makes them pro-inflammatory?
Well, just so that listeners don't, freak out a little bit, because people tend to freak out when we start talking about sugar and flour, because everyone sort of craves that they want to eat. I'm at a convention now, and it's all over the place, and people just wig out about it. So the idea of having a little bit, it really isn't a big deal. But the problem is when we eat enough of it to have a blood sugar surge that is protracted. And this typically happens when we just keep eating the stuff or if we develop insulin resistance. So what happens is when one overeats sugar, flour calories, the blood sugar rises and it rushes into all cells, whether they're insulin dependent like muscle, liver, or not. And that rush of glucose, sugar, flour, into cells causes the mitochondria to overproduce free radicals. Mm-hmm. Now, simultaneously, now short term, no big deal, but simultaneously, when one does that long term, we're supposed to also eat antioxidants. And the most important ones are actually carotenoids and polyphenols, or what used to be called bioflavonoids, because they inhibit the free radicals that are produced by the mitochondria. So when you just create free radicals without the antioxidants, the free radicals have to do something. And what they do is they initiate a domino chain reaction where these nuclear molecules are turned on and we create inflammatory chemicals like prostaglandins. Some of your audience members might recognize the term cytokines, which mm-hmm. become more popular. They didn't even exist in the language back when I was in college.
Just a way to understand cytokines is the way you feel when you have a flu. That's because you're overloaded with cytokines as your body endeavors to fight off an invader.
So the interesting thing is that even like pancreas cells, beta cells that make insulin, when they're burdened by a big sugar blast, the beta cells of the pancreas release cytokines also. Any cell that is exposed to excess glucose produces cytokines. So we typically think about this in terms like what you just described would be an immune reaction. Like the immune system turns on, and it should. Cytokines are important for healing, but when they're produced indiscriminately by overeating sugar and flour and refined oil calories, then we create like a low-grade, it's almost like a low-grade flu state. Mm. And that's what most chronic patients feel like. They just don't feel well. They feel like they've got a low-grade flu state or just malaise, not feeling well, without having any of the mucus production or digestive disturbances. They just feel lousy for 30 or 40 years. So that is caused by the same chemicals that give you fever, for example, just at a lower level. And every cell exposed, whether it's a cartilage cell, a joint cell, a blood vessel cell, a pancreas cell, heart cell, it makes no difference. Every cell exposed to sugar and flour calories releases inflammatory chemistry in response.
Dr. Seaman, we're going to pause for just a couple of moments here to let one of our sponsors share a message with us. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide.
Okay, thanks for listening and thanks for supporting our sponsors. And now back to Dr. David Seaman on the subject of pro-inflammatory and anti-inflammatory diets. His book is The Deflame Diet. So you also have it in for poor quality oils. And you're not fat phobic. It's not so much that you're in principle against fat intake, but certain oils you feel are pro-inflammatory.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. If you think about the scientists use the term separated fats. So for example, if you eat an olive, you don't feel like oozing with oil. You got to press a whole lot of them to get the oil. So that oil is separated from the olive. If you eat coconut, you know, it has some fattiness in it, but you don't feel the ooze of oil if you eat a raw coconut. So you got to press a lot of them. But when you press them, you get the coconut oil separated. So the same thing for butter and all the rest. So there are basically three common separated oils that have been used by humans over the ages. And those would be butter, coconut oil, and olive oil. It was impossible to really get flaxseed or sunflower seed oil decades and hundreds of years ago because the presses were not that effective. By the time that occurred, most of those oils were used for lubrication of our old, more primitive machinery and illumination. And so the corn, safflower, sunflower oils were never consumed. They were used for lubrication and illumination. The human body is not wired to live on calories that contain those most common, they're omega-6 oils, which I know that you and your audience is quite aware of. So the omega-6 oils come from corn oil, safflower, sunflower, cottonseed, and not as bad, but equally elevated in omega-6s, soybean oil. So you need to put a target on those guys and avoid them only, you know, once in a while, because they turn the flame on for sure.
Mm-hmm. And are there any other dietary culprits? I mean, say you have an allergy or an intolerance to a certain food. That may not apply to everyone, but could it be that for some people, certain foods are pro-inflammatory, say dairy or wheat? Not for everyone, but
right
on an individual
basis.
Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. That can be across the board. Any food could be allergic. Most common, though, you know, dairy with your lactose intolerance, it's not really so much an allergy, but wheat with the gluten sensitivity and perhaps a wheat allergy. But of course, there's a good reason to avoid a wheat in general because wheat becomes how do you eat wheat? You eat it with sugar on it typically, or salt as a pretzel. And so wheat is sort of a way to stimulate that dietary crackhead, as I call it. But wheat, though, because of celiac disease and gluten sensitivity, becomes a food that can be shockingly pro-inflammatory for some people. And that gluten problem is interesting. Historically, people were told, well, it's only if you have celiac disease. And a lot of people are unaware of this, and I don't know how long ago it was, because I forget as, you know, the years go by, but the researchers coined a term, atypical celiac disease. And this typically hits people as they age, but an example would be a 50-year-old guy, and this is actually a case history that's been published in the literature, 50-year-old guy, headaches on and off, they become more frequent. He also developed disequilibrium, ataxia, he couldn't walk well, he lost track of time and space, his vision changed, he started to feel nauseous, and turned out that was all due to gluten. But he got GI symptoms after all those neurologic symptoms. So for some people, the atypical celiac disease is manifested as migraine headaches, which is a pretty common condition.
And we have we have the book now, Grain Brain, which makes the connection between neurodegenerative diseases and gluten intake, with or without frank celiac disease, because it's only the minority of patients
right.
who exhibit the intestinal changes that can be confirmed via endoscopy that have classic celiac.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that Dr. Perlmutter's book is a must-read for someone who just needs more ammo and wants to dive into it deeper. And the same thing could be said for wheat belly. Those two books, you read those two books, you might develop a little bit of wheat fear, which isn't a bad thing, even if you don't have celiac disease, because it's very, no one mindlessly overeats broccoli. What's wrong? You know, they say, Seema, what happened to you? You got so big. Yeah, I couldn't stop eating salad.
Right.
I mean, I just couldn't stop myself, you know?
Never
it's
happened.
Not that. It could never happen. Jelly beans and pretzels and whatever other dietary crack choice that one prefers. So for me, it's wise to limit those, the wheat calories, because when we eat those calories, we typically add oils to it, which then adds to the calories. People like to put butter on bread, and of course what do? They blame the butter, not the bread.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that avoiding wheat is a smart move, and get our carbohydrates. Now the other thing too about grains that's typically not appreciated, because it becomes emotional and stressful when we start talking about it, but dietary potassium is never discussed, and potassium historically was consumed at about 7,000 milligrams per day. Now, the RDI for is only 4,700, and before that was even lower. The average American consumes less than 3,000 milligrams of potassium, and they consume 6,000, typically, milligrams of sodium.
Right.
Now, that reversal of sodium-potassium and the deficient potassium intake sets us up for a whole host of pro-inflammatory changes as well, heart disease and autoimmune disease.
So it's not. So you're saying it's not the absolute amount of sodium. It's the inversion of the ratio. It's like having a lot of processed foods that are loaded with sodium but don't deliver any potassium. That creates an imbalance, rather than just the absolute amount of potassium.
I don't think that really anyone should be over 2,000 milligrams of sodium per day. But we got to be getting our. I mean, maybe 3,000. I mean, no one knows for sure. And the problem is the dietary waters have become so muddied that it's really hard to know what are the actual limits from person to person. So you have to be general.
Mm-hmm.
So my feeling is you want to get 7,000 milligrams of potassium, unless you have hyperkalemia, which is, you know, high potassium in the blood, which is not terribly common in the walking population. It's much more common in the hospitalized population. But then keeping your sodium below 2 grams per day, 2,000 milligrams, and people will be in shock to find out how much sodium they're taking in. And I wouldn't be surprised. Well, based upon the evidence that's been around for the past 20, 30 years or so, that's probably the reason why people develop hypertension much more rapidly than they would just by standard aging.
Indeed. So what are some of the super anti-inflammatory foods that you really want to accentuate in your diet? You enumerate them in the book, The Deflame Diet.
Yeah, I think it boils down to, I personally shy away from, not that you used it, but the word superfood, only because what if someone doesn't like blueberries? And they say, oh, geez, I mean, I don't like a superfood, you know. Well, if you look at, say, the Katavans down in New Guinea, they didn't eat blueberries. They ate papayas. Oh, I don't like papayas. Well, they ate guavas. Well, you find the fruit that you like, and in most cases, when you look at the, and this is really important when people go online, because this is the best way, and I like nutritiondata.com, but there are many. What you can look at is, and it should be done based upon calories, not based upon serving size like a cup. You want to look at calories per serving, because that's really, well, the metric for weight management in general. And if you look at, for example, 300 calories of oatmeal, you get about maybe 300 milligrams of potassium. You get 300 calories of romaine lettuce, you're talking 4,000 or 5,000 milligrams of potassium.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe two-thirds.
Which is interesting, because when they sell potassium in a health food store, you can only get a 99 milligram potassium. So
you
think, well, I'm going to take a potassium supplement. Well, it's like, forget about the potassium supplement. Just eat a big salad. You'll get 10 times as much.
Exactly. And the other thing, too, about the potassium supplement is that when you just take a pure potassium supplement, you get this blast of potassium into your system, and you're supposed to get potassium released into the system during the digestive process and therefore not get a big, massive load of it. Hmm. But, yeah, it's ridiculous. You just cannot go take potassium Indeed. And expect to get your potassium. Because also, the potassium-rich foods, which are your fruits and vegetables, they also contain fiber. And also, on a caloric basis, if you take 300 calories of, say, broccoli or romaine lettuce, you're getting between 15 and 30 grams of fiber. You get only 8 grams of fiber with that amount of calories from oatmeal. So on a caloric basis, you get way more fiber and nutrients, your phytonutrients, your bioflavonoids and carotenoids, and for listeners who may not know what that is, your color in your vegetation. The color is present there because of the carotenoids like beta-carotene and many others, and your bioflavonoids. They give the unique color to your vegetation. You don't get any of that if you just take a potassium pill. So you want to get the color. So I think that people really should be eating lots of vegetation for the fiber content, the potassium, and the phytonutrients.
Indeed.
But you cannot get those at adequate amounts by taking supplements, in my opinion.
Indeed. And so, and we talked a lot about diet, but inflammation is also related to other aspects of lifestyle. So you mentioned that sleep, exercise, and stress also have an impact on inflammation. How does that work?
You know, it's a bit more challenging to think, well, so you do a drive-by self-shooting and just wolf down 6 donuts. You can see the culprit. It's right there. And you can and the calories went in. But let's just say that you don't sleep. Now, think about it like this. If for the next 7 nights, you only get 4 hours sleep per night, most people are going to feel it probably the next day, but certainly 2 or 3 or 4 days in, they're going to feel terrible. And so what happens is when we have physiologic perturbations where we disrupt cycles, rhythms, not enough sleep, and that typically is 6 to 9 hours. And by the way, also for listeners whose sleep isn't that great, naps help. It's a 24-hour cycle. You typically need 6 hours. Mm-hmm. Now, someone may say, oh, I need 8. Well, then you need 8. There are outliers who need 5, but the average person between 6 and 9 is what they need. So if you do not get that, that acts as a physiologic stressor, and the body reacts by increasing the amount of circulating inflammatory chemistry. Same thing with stress. Stressors, and they're typically psychologic stressors, and we're burdened by psychological stressors all the time. When you dwell upon them, it's the dwelling upon them that becomes disturbing to you, and it bothers you. That bothered feeling is an inflammatory state. It's literally impossible to feel sad without having a low-grade inflammatory event. You can't feel depressed without inflammation. You can't feel angry without inflammation. Now, of course, anger and depression, depending upon the situation, if someone you love dearly passes away, you can feel depressed. Now, that's an inflammatory state that you're in, so it's normal to feel it, but living in that state forever is catastrophic on a long-term basis. So lack of sleep and stressing, and then you couple that with a lack of exercise, we are meant to move. When we actually move, we activate anti-inflammatory genes. Mm-hmm. So the modern lifestyle is one that is the opposite of that. So the stress and the lack of sleep thing is a little bit more difficult to describe mechanistically. We just have to look at it as a perturbation. We're perturbed. Mm-hmm. The body gets perturbed physiologically without enough sleep, and with stress that becomes chronic. And so then the same cells release inflammatory chemistry. In that case, it's mostly immune-related cells.
You know, they recently did a study. This is right in my wheelhouse because I'm an anthropology major in college. In paleobiology, they did a study of bone remains, and they looked in particular at the knee joints in fossil remains that they found that were thousands of years old. And what they concluded is that in the last century, there's been a major uptick in the inflammation of the knee joint among individuals over a certain age. It was thought that, well, you know, that's what happens. You get older, your knees wear out, it's the wear and tear phenomenon. But there's more to it than wear and tear. In fact, some studies suggest that moderate exercise, maybe not doing ultra marathons until you're 85, actually help to preserve your knee cartilage?
Well, that makes a great deal of sense, and I think that everybody who is in healthcare has been taught the wear and tear terminology. It's like a mantra. Osteoarthritis, wear and tear. Better terminology would be wear and then lack of repair. That mm-hmm. is the problem. If someone exercises, typically, you know, if you do a lot of, you know, a big leg workout today, you're busy squatting or whatever, you're doing lunging, you wouldn't do it tomorrow because you have to repair after you wear, which is, everyone thinks about that. Oh, yeah, of course that makes sense from an exercise perspective. And that's just not a plot. Now, imagine if you were to squat every day, every day, every day. You would wear and you wouldn't repair. Mm-hmm. Now you'd end up with a chronic muscle inflammatory state of some kind. And so the problem with osteoarthritis is a wear and lack of repair. And as we age also, if we eat the wrong fatty acids, we actually insert into our joint tissue, our joint cartilage, omega-6 fatty acids. That's amazing. People are born with no omega-6 fatty acids in their joints. And as we age, the omega-6s progressively increase, and it comes from what we eat. Hmm. So you're absolutely right. The modern scenario is terrible. And sugar and flour calories, they stimulate the inflammatory reaction of our joints. So it's absolutely correct that it is OA could be sort of in general, long-term, more common, but it is not the same scenario that we have today as we had in yesteryear. Imagine being a hunter-gatherer with brutal OA when you're 50. You're a dead hunter-gatherer mm-hmm. because how could you run around and hunt and gather? And now you can just sit on a scooter and cruise through a Sam's Club on your scooter. So, yeah, it's really bad news. You're absolutely correct about that. I'm really, really glad to hear the papers are coming out like that.
And finally, you know, I think it bears mentioning that anytime you have excess adipose tissue, i.e. body fat, that is an inflammation factory for your body. It promotes inflammation, right? So any measure that you can undertake, whether it be a combination of diet and exercise to get some of that fat off, will lower your overall inflammatory quotient.
Yeah, it's really interesting. As we accumulate adipose tissue, as our fat cells swell in size, they actually attract immune cells into the adipose tissue mass, and these immune cells come in because it's a foreign experience. It's a stressor. It's actually a difficult concept to kind of embrace if one just thinks about body fat as a storage of calories. But stored body fat in excess actually turns on the immune system. You get a pro-inflammatory immune profile. Pro-inflammatory immune cells invade your adipose tissue mass, and they start to dump the inflammatory cytokines, and it creates a low-grade infection-like state, so you can feel malaise and not have a fever. It's that catastrophic long-term.
Hmm. And I certainly see that in my patients who suffer from overweight and unclear causation of their bodily aches and pains. Well, okay, this has been a really fascinating excursion into the world of inflammation, and you've made an outstanding contribution with your early enunciation of the principle that there can be a diet-induced pro-inflammatory state. That's the title of the paper that you wrote presciently way back in 2002, and it's a great contribution to our modern dialogue. Now the word anti-inflammatory diet, pro-inflammatory diet, has become part of the lexicon. So congratulations to you for introducing it and for elaborating on it in your new book, The Deflame Diet. So Dr. Seaman, where can people get a hold of it, the usual sources, and is there a website for more information?
Yeah, the usual sources, Amazon, they can get the book. If doctors want to carry it in their office or stores want to carry it, they can buy volume discounts from deflame.com, my website. I do on and off, depending upon how I'm moved by information. I've got a YouTube channel that's fledgling but growing where, for example, the grass-fed beef talk, you can go to Aldi if there's an Aldi in your local area, and Aldi now has grass-fed beef that's $3-$4 cheaper than what you'll get at some of the more expensive health food stores. So I've got a Deflame Nutrition is the YouTube channel. Mm-hmm. Deflame Diet is the book. Deflame.com and Deflame Nutrition for Facebook. I can reach all three of those.
Deflame.com is the website.
BeefLame.com is a website, and right from there you can get right to Facebook and YouTube.
Excellent.
And get the book.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Seaman, for joining us. It's been great having you on. We appreciate very much your contribution. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine Podcast.